Hello and welcome to Theatre Voice. I'm Alex Sears and today I'm at the offices of the English Touring Theatre to talk to the award-winning playwright Jonathan Harvey, whose latest show, Canary, is currently being performed at the Liverpool Playhouse before transferring to the Hampstead. Harvey was born in Liverpool in 1968 and his other plays include the groundbreaking and inspirational Beautiful Thing, which was also made into a film, Babies, Guiding Star, Hushabye Mountain, and Out in the Open. Oh, and I must also mention his musical collaboration with the Pet Shop Boys, Closer to Heaven. His television credits include Gimme 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 and Coronation Street, for which he was responsible for developing the first gay character, and he is currently undertaking the marathon task of condensing 7,000 episodes and 2,000 storylines into a single stage production, which will tour the UK later this year in celebration of the show's 50th anniversary. Welcome to Theatre Voice, Jonathan Harvey.
Thank you very much.
Could you start by talking about the background to Canary? What was your inspiration?
Can I just say something first?
I didn't
create the first gay character in Coronation Street. I came on just as it was hitting the screen, so I did write a lot for him, but it would be unfair to the other writers.
Okay.
The background to Canary. Gosh, it's... Well, I suppose when I was young, I've always written plays that are about being gay and about the gay experience and my experience as a gay man, I suppose. And I suppose when I was younger, I wrote plays about coming out and first love and things like this. And I suppose, you know, I'm 42 in June. And so, you know, I've been writing since I was 17. So I suppose I'm not in the twilight of my years by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm older and I've seen changes in the gay community, I suppose. And I suppose I wanted to write something that reflected that. I think that was sort of inevitable at this point in my life and career. And so I always thought there was something interesting. I think when I was in my 20s, when I was in my teens and 20s, you know, lots of friends were dying of AIDS. And I suppose
that was in the 1980s.
Yeah, 1980s and 90s. And I think I've always been very aware of the other friends of mine who've responded well to combination therapy and have survived. And, I've, you know, that's sort of been a figure in my work for a while. And I suppose... So I've always been interested in the history, in the way things change the older you get. And so with Canary, I started thinking about... Originally, I was going to write this play for 2008, when Liverpool was capital of culture. And I wrote a play, and it was in three acts. And it was about the same group of mates in Liverpool. The first act was in the 80s, the second in the 90s, and the third act was in the noughties. And it was all right. It was sort of sub-Tennessee Williams piece of pretentious crap at times, but like very much like the sound of its own voice. But I think I didn't go far enough. When I was doing the workshop of it, fortunately the Playhouse did a workshop of it, and I soon realised it hadn't really gone deep enough, and I realised that there were other stories I wanted to tell about being gay, and that some of those stories weren't about stuff that's happened in my lifetime. And at the same time, I'd been thinking about doing a television series, a bit like Our Friends in the North, where you'd follow the gay experience over 50 years. And so nobody was really interested in making that for the television, but I'd done quite a bit of research into it. And so I threw away the play that I was doing in the workshop because I didn't like it, and sort of started again from scratch.
And what didn't you like? Was it the characters or just the fact that you
confined
them to one place?
Or? I had set myself a few problems that I didn't resolve.
Okay.
It was all set in one location.
Yeah.
So you were sort of glued to that spot for 30 years. And also the characters I'd come up with didn't allow me to tell as many stories as I wanted to tell. I felt it was quite important that if you're doing a story about gay history, that one of the central figures has to die. And I know that sounds gloomy, but in the play I've done now, where there's lots of characters and lots of stories going on, it's vital to the play, but you don't suddenly have this huge loss of one of your favourite characters disappearing. And so I just knew that I needed older gay men and younger gay men, not just about a group of mates at the sort of same time in their lives. And I felt it needed to be more of a kaleidoscope of sort of jumping backwards and forwards. And And I just thought you had to work a bit harder and be a bit cleverer, I suppose.
Yeah. As it is now, the plot outline, it's about really three eras, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's about the 1960s.
Yes.
That kind of, which seems now a very primitive time almost, because of the, you know, because it was illegal and the pressure against gay people. 1980s, which is of course overshadowed by the gradually and then rapidly developing AIDS epidemic.
Yeah.
I mean, and then now, where apparently lots of things have changed, but as you're suggesting in a place, some don't change. Tell us a bit about the kind of storyline, because it focuses quite a lot on Tom, a police chief, doesn't it?
Yeah, the place sort of opens. It's got several openings, but eventually when it gets going, it opens in a posh townhouse in Islington in present day, and Tom, who is the chief of police for a London borough, is holed up in his house with his wife and his daughter, who's in her 30s, and an unusual figure who's like a sort of you know, a gay celebrity off the television has arrived to come bearing bad news. And outside, the paparazzi are there and they're waiting to break a story. Mm. And you don't really know what the link is with this gay celebrity. Think Graham Norton or John Barham. And it's someone who is Mr. Saturday Night, acceptable face of gayness. I was trying, with that character, I was trying to think, gosh, how do you sum up what it's like to be gay now? What changes have been made? And I thought, well, I know we had Larry Grayson in the 70s and stuff like that, but, you know, there are out gay people at the centre of, you know, Saturday Night Teddy. Yeah. So I thought that was quite good for a character. But he's come to this family and he said, the press, we don't know why he's come, why he's got a link with this family, but he comes and says, the News of the World are running a story tomorrow saying that you've been having a relationship with a man for years. Yeah. They've got several other stories on you. What are you going to do? And really, in the present day, the play is about the choice that this chief of police has to make. Does he come out and upset his family, or is he honest about who he is? And it's a very simple choice he has to make, but in order to make that, he sort of looks back on his life. Meanwhile, the gay celebrity goes in the garden with the daughter and starts telling him about her life. And so you have sort of two life stories running in tandem. Tom with his lover Billy from the 60s, and then Russell and his best mate Mickey running away to heaven in the 80s, and you follow their stories and what happens to them to the present day, and the stories collide and interweave hopefully in a very clever way, and there is a reason he's there. The two stories are linked, but we don't find out until just before the interval heart-stopping link hopefully is. You know, and along the way, the stories you tell about those two couples, one couple and one group of friends, hopefully covers a lot of what's happened to gay people over the years. So when Tom looks back on his life, he was caught in bed with another guy in 1962, and the police arrested them.
It's your kind of bent moment, that one, isn't it? When the door suddenly smashes open,
and
people in uniform come running in.
I must reread Bent to see if I can steal anything from it. Yes, but then Tom makes a choice, because Tom's a young policeman, and his father, who's head of his police force, says to him, well, you can either be a sodomite for the rest of your life, or you can say that this other guy attacked you. And so he says on the stand that the other guy attacked him. And so you also follow this other guy's life, Billy, who is sent for aversion therapy instead of going to prison.
Now, did you do research about that? Because it was in another play as well, The Pride, at the Royal Court. And it just seems so incredibly primitive. You know?
It really primitive. I mean, they used the same techniques as they used in the sort of Nazi concentration camps to change people and make them into more of the master race. But it was going on until the 70s in this country, but, you know, it was there in 1962. I mean, don't forget, I did a degree in psychology, and in my fourth year, which was 1990, I did a part of my course was called Abnormal Psychology, and in it I could choose five different essays, and one of them was The Causes of Homosexuality,
because
it was still classified as a psychiatric illness. And that was, well, I was at university from 86 to 90. So I remember I was quite subversive for a 19-year-old, and I did a talk about the causes of heterosexuality and got an A. But, you know, it's horrible reading stuff about people who've had aversion therapy. And it was offered sometimes to people who'd been caught, you know, having sex as they called it, gross indecency. And sometimes, rather than getting 2 years, it was the same law that Oscar Wilde had been sent down for, you know. So the choice was 2 years, inverted commas, hard labour, which by the 60s would have just been meant prison. But with the advent of, you know, aversion therapy being seen as a cure by, you know, reputable establishments, that was sometimes offered by the courts as well. So Billy in the play goes and has aversion therapy.
But the nice thing about your version is that obviously it doesn't, in inverted commas, cure him.
No, he's sort of, he has...
And in fact, it makes him more militant, I think.
It makes him very militant. He comes out of there. I mean, the other stuff I read in the research said that, you know, it didn't really cure people. It messed them up.
No, of course, yeah.
But it didn't really cure them. It just made them a bit dysfunctional about sex, as if they weren't sort of...
It's a kind of traumatizing experience. That's the
And so with Billy, he comes out of there and he gets angry and he does something about it and he joins the Gay Liberation Front, as you do. So it's I'm not going to say it was great for Billy. It's horrible, and as you follow his story up until, you know, years later, you see that it's still creating problems for him, and he does eventually snap and does something about it.
Yeah. Now, you've obviously enjoyed a very successful TV career.
I've had a go.
Why did you return to theatre? Is this your first theatre play?
My first full length theatre play for about 9 years.
Yeah.
I've always meant to, and time just ran away with me, I suppose. And I suppose this was commissioned about 5 or 6 years ago, because originally it was going to be on in 2008. So I have been working on this for quite some time.
Was it always a co-production with Liverpool, Hampstead?
It was.
And ETT?
It was originally, I went to Liverpool Playhouse because Gemma Bodinet was running it, and Deborah Aden, and I had a good relationship with them. And also I wanted my next play to be in Liverpool, because that's where I'm from. But to be honest, I think it was just a case of they couldn't afford an out-and-out commission, so they asked Hampstead. They thought, you know, London runs, so Hampstead were in on it. But it was only very late in the day that English Touring Theatre came in and offered the tour, and I suppose put more money.
And is there a lot of doubling? Because obviously,
a lot of doubling. Every actor plays about 3 or 4 parts. Yeah.
And that also has a great resonance, doesn't it? Because you see the same character type, or is it just confusing now?
Well, I don't know. I don't know until I see it. Yeah. But the thing we have to work very hard on is to not confuse the audience. It's sort of confusing enough, jumping around in time. And, you know, parts are split between actors. So 2 different actors play Russell, for instance. So, you know, there's one actor playing
young Russell and old Russell. And young Tom and old Tom, presumably, who probably also plays Tom's father.
No, he doesn't.
Oh,
older Russell plays Tom's father. But older Tom plays Mary Whitehouse, which is very nice.
Okay, yes. That is. Now, it's a big, epic 3-act play with a large cast of characters, let us say, public as well as private. Mm. You have Margaret Thatcher as well. Mm. Why did you choose this structure?
I don't know, really. I mean, I wanted to write something big, bold and epic.
I mean, were you thinking of a particular stage for it?
Well, I was thinking of the Playhouse, really, because that was who the commission was for. Yeah. And I was thinking it's a big space, and so it had to be a big... I remember Gemma Bodinet saying, plays that work at the Playhouse are big... Not necessarily big plays, but plays with big ideas. And so that was what I tried to do. And I suppose once I chose the subject matter, and once I decided I wanted to do... The play was going to be spread over 50 years. It had to be a certain length to accommodate that. I hate long plays. You know, I will be trimming away in previews. But it just sort of... This one has to be the length it has to be, really.
Mm.
We'll see.
Mm. It's a comedy, but it's also very serious.
I think it's a drama.
Okay.
With funny bits.
Yeah. It has got some funny bits.
Yeah.
And we'll get on to some of those, maybe. And almost that's your default position, isn't it? The sort of comedy plus pain.
Yeah.
Or is this one more pain plus comedy?
Well, I think it's more pain plus comedy. But yeah, I suppose comedy, especially in theatre, is often used in quite a dismissive way. I'm not saying you're saying that, but do you know what I mean? If it's billed as a comedy, it's like, this is... I know that will get
just
more people
an easy
to
laugh.
See it.
Yeah.
But no, I think... Yes, it's funny, and hopefully there are moments when the audience will be really having a good laugh. But I think hopefully you can subvert that with shocking people as well.
Mm. Yeah, and there were one or two quite sort of 80s scenes.
Yeah, really. I mean, when you think of the aversion therapy scene, the worst thing we could have is for people to be giggling through that. So you have to be really careful how you use your language and what message you're giving to the audience, that it's not safe to laugh now, but it's safe to laugh now, you know.
Yeah. Let's look at some of the characters then. Tom character.
Yeah.
Obviously, I mean, he's a character who's gay, but he marries. He creates this respectable front.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure whether it's just for the career or what he's exactly doing.
I think he's a sort of victim of his era. And I think... without going into too much detail, he makes a bad decision very early on in his life. He takes the advice of his father and he claims that this guy attacked him, whereas actually they were making love, they were lovers.
Yeah.
And on the back of that, to save face with his family and with his job, he makes this choice, and the rest of his life has the sort of the dominoes falling over because of that choice he made when he was very young.
Yeah.
And he got married on the back of that, had a baby on the back of that, and everything sort of went wrong from there on. But
well, it was two children, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's slightly more complex than that, because I don't know if he himself at the beginning of the play would say he would identify as gay. I think that would still be an alien word to him. But through the course of the play, he has to sort of take ownership of that, I suppose.
Yeah. And by then, I suppose, he's got used to this kind of... But perhaps a bisexual role, or...
Yeah, I mean,
He's settled with his wife.
He's nearly at retirement age.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to go out and tell the press he's gay. He could lie and save his job and retire in 6 months' time, but he has to make that choice.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he's become very good at lying over the years. He's lied to his wife, he's lied to his daughter, he's lied to his children. He is a gay man, but he's so wrapped up in his lies that he's really tormented by that.
Yeah, and you're sort of definite with that kind of label, he's a gay man, rather than, well, he's unsure or he's drawn both ways.
Yes, I think he's gay.
Oh, right, okay. But so it's not just an emotional repressed opportunity.
I think it's really important for the play that he's a gay man.
Yeah.
But he's repressed it over the years because of various bad decisions he's made.
Yeah, okay, that sounds fair. What about his wife? Where does she put up with that?
Well, I think
she likes her house.
she loves her house. She's very materialistic.
Yeah.
And she, from an early age, just thinks that's what married life's about. She got married in the early 60s. She doesn't know any different. She's probably never had an orgasm. You know, she just thinks this is what men are like. She's got a really good-looking husband who's got a good job. Kids are a bit of a nightmare, but, you know, she keeps going. And she just assumes that that's how all women of that age feel. And I suppose a lot of them do, husbands.
Well, I do remember the sort of early 60s, and people didn't really talk about sex, and it's one of the things that annoys me about lots of TV dramas and some plays, that there's that anachronism, they're talking about an orgasm or how they feel, or masturbation or something, when people really didn't.
No.
I think the character in your play says they had a wet dream was actually quite, you know, that's about as far as you would go, to sort of talk about something. But, what about Russell then?
Well, Russell is... in the present day, he's Mr. Saturday Night on the television. But when we first meet him in the play, he's sort of 18 and he's run away to London and he's trying to make out he's not gay, despite studying musical theatre at drama school.
Yeah.
And his best friend is Mickey, who is quite a political young gay man, who's very angry with the world and wants to change the world.
Yeah. And also wants to change Russell.
Make
up your mind,
they
Russell.
Have a really sort of combative relationship, especially about sexuality. And Russell is sort of the opinion that if he comes out, which I think is very true in the 80s, if he comes out, he will never get his leading men roles. But when Mickey gets AIDS and dies, Russell sort of sells his soul to the devil, if you like, and he says on Mickey's deathbed, I'm going to come out, I'm going to tell, I'll be the best out gay actor in the world. And we then meet him again years later, and he's starred in Les Mis, he's done all the West End shows, and now he's got his own show on a Saturday night. And things are going really well for him on a career level, but, you know, the other thing we learn about...
Yeah.
Yeah, but he's
he's fucked really, because excuse my French, he was diagnosed with HIV at the same time as Mickey. But remarkably he survived and got the combination therapy and is now doing really well, but he's really haunted by survivor guilt because his best friend died. And he wasn't in love with him, but there was a bit of a love story. They were really close, they were sisters, and I think, you know, never a day goes by when he doesn't miss his friend. So yeah, although he's got everything on a plate, he's got a great, you know, career, money, probably got a really nice house. It sort of all counts for nothing to him, because I think he feels what he needs to get over is his survivor guilt during the play. He needs to let go of a few demons in order to move on and be happy.
And your characters, obviously they're based on people you know and on yourself and on your imagination. In what kind of proportions, or is it all so mixed up?
Well, with this play, it's not really based on people I know. It was more, I did lots of reading, and I read lots and lots of sort of oral history stuff, and sort of pieced together people's life stories from lots of different people, I suppose. So, and I just read some really good books. The best book I read was called Walking After Midnight, which the Hall Carpenter Archive produced, which was, they interviewed about 15 or 20 gay men in about 1985. And they just talk to the interviewer, and they've got just talk about their lives, and you know, there were older men, younger men. I mean, the sadness is because when it was published, a lot of them died soon after the book. But you know, you've got a whole myriad of experiences from, you know, 1920 onwards with these different men, and they were just great. You know, obviously you can't make it up, so the stories were great and really touching, and so I was just able to. Not steal, but I was able to lift little details, like there was, you know, a guy diagnosed with AIDS in 1984, and how he would be crying out for a glass of water and no one would bring him one because the nurses were so scared to treat him. So we, you know, I've used that in the play.
That's a really quite,
I know, and
strong moment.
I hope so. It's sort of hopefully quite theatrical as well, with the nurse appearing looking like a spaceman. But.
That fear of infection.
Absolutely. So it was, this is hopefully more testimony to those sort of people I've read about, rather than it being based on any one particular person.
And did you do any interviews yourself? Or
no, I didn't.
But you probably draw on memories of talking.
I slept with lots of people. No, I didn't. I just suppose the more modern stuff, I mean, the more modern stuff on HIV and stuff like that, I've not ones that I've lived through it personally, but I've got very close friends who have, and I did lose a very good friend in the 90s, so things like that I'd sort of lived through and I understood. And you know, the friend of mine who died had a very separate family relationship with his family, who he'd not really spoken to for a long time, and then all his gay friends in London, and as he was dying he said, I want to see my mum again. He'd not seen his mum for 10 years, and she came, and so I wanted an element of that in the play, this sort of, dividing these two camps and then bringing them together. You know, fireworks go off, I suppose. So things like that were, you know, it wasn't like I interviewed people, but I just innately knew it, I suppose.
It's ironic talking about the main character is the chief of police and hearing the police helicopter while we're talking.
He's come to haunt us.
Yeah, exactly.
Shut up.
Talking of themes now, I mean, death, obviously. Yeah. And I do remember you once telling me that when you came out in the 1980s, there was obviously that whole thing with AIDS going on, and you had to confront death as quite a youngish person, at least the possibility, and that ghastly relationship between sex and death, and then watching what the government was doing, which was so far behind what not only people in the gay community, but anybody who was an aware, progressive, thinking person.
Well, the one thing that sticks in my mind is the day after I lost my virginity with a guy. A mate of mine said to me, "Have you heard the latest? When gay people have sex these days, they die." And that was like, you know, there was no first flush of love for me. It was all like panic. And I remember coming out to my parents when I was 18 and telling my mum, and my mum's a nurse, and the first thing my mum said was, one of the first things she said was, you know, if you get AIDS, I'll nurse you. Which was a lovely, beautiful thing to say.
Well, it is, yeah.
But it was always there, I think, through my teens and early 20s, was I was just assumed that I wouldn't live beyond 35, you know. It was just something we just accepted, I suppose.
Mm. Mm. But it runs through all your plays, I think, almost.
Yeah. You know, even the one about football.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, it's there. That's all about survivor guilt.
Yes.
You know.
Because there's two, aren't there? There's two parallel stories guiding stuff. Yeah, yeah. The other thing that's always in your plays is the family secret, which is great because it's dramatic, obviously.
Okay.
And we're not going to give away the ending of this play.
No.
But is that something that you put in because actually, you know,
it's
a great way of telling the story?
I suppose secrets are interesting to me. I can't picture where the other secrets are, but no, you're right. Yes, I suppose it's a dramatic device that appeals to me, that there's a secret, it's got to come out, and that's when the cat's out of the bag, what happens?
Yeah, because out in the open, there's all this thing about so-and-so tells so-and-so something, but then somebody else tells somebody, and...
Yes, and the secret comes out just before the interval, just like in this play.
Now, obviously, there are other things that concern you. One of them is the homophobia in the media. And I don't know, what's your feeling? Have things got better now compared to 30 years ago?
Yes, I think, you know, politically things have got better.
Yeah.
I don't know whether that's... I think attitudes have changed, but I think that's also because gay people have got stronger, so they're more likely to argue back. But, you know, you've only got to look at Jan Moyer in the Daily Mail after Stephen Gately's death.
Yeah.
You know, it's there. That felt like a very 80s piece of writing to me. It was all dark and insipid. So I think it's still there, and I think homophobia is still there with people, you know, queer bashings and hate crimes. And, you know, just the other week, two friends of mine were jumped on outside a club in Vauxhall and beaten to the ground, you know. Mm. And so I think as society has moved on and, you know, Tony Blair brought a lot of good to the gay community, I think, with equalising the age of consent and civil partnerships. But I think what the play tries and does is say, don't get complacent. There are still issues that need tackling, I suppose.
Mm. And also, I think you're also saying that the religious strand, which is exemplified in your play by Mrs. Whitehouse and the Festival of Light, that is something that's a recurring thing, which is basically really bad news for gay people.
Yeah, I mean, yes, I think a certain strand of Christianity is really bad news for gay people, the more sort of evangelical, where Christianity is fueled by hatred and a desire to bully. But I don't think that's every Christian. I think the average Christian is reasonably unhomophobic, and I think most Church of England churches are not homophobic places. It's just with anything, the sort of militancy of that is less tolerant.
Mary Whitehouse was running a campaign.
Absolutely. I'm talking about now.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that's totally exemplified in the campaign that we show in the play, where she uses Christianity really as a shield for her own bigotry.
Yeah,
exactly. It's a perfect excuse. Mm. This isn't what Jesus would have done, so let's be horrible to them. So she, in 1971, set up the Festival of Light to shine light into moral darkness in the world, which the GLF, the Gay Liberation Front, infiltrated and rather marvelously interrupted.
That's a fantastic scene also in your play.
Should be good fun to watch as well.
I thought about this religious thing because do you remember writing in the introduction to one of the volumes of your plays about your friend John, who had that horrendous experience at Hillsborough, firstly, but then actually found God and kept advising you not
to. He kept barring the door to stop me leaving the house in case I got run over by a bus.
Yeah.
But you see, I see that as religious extremism, and I think any form of extremism is bad.
Yeah.
You know, I come from... my background is very much church-going, and my dad was the local organist, my uncle was a vicar, my great-aunt was a vicar.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so I'm, you know, I go to church myself every now and again, so I'm, you know, and I would say I was a Christian.
Yeah.
So I don't have much trouble, because I know that most Christians think I'm all right, but I know that, you know, I do think it's a cover for bigotry sometimes. And I think it depends really whether you think that the Bible is divine dictation, you know, that God decreed it, or whether you think it's a load of stories transcribed over the years to try and help us make sense of our lives, and I tend to think it's the latter. And so you can sort of, not saying ignore the bad bits and just pick out the bits you want, but I just think it's used
in a way that it needn't be a lot of the time.
Mm. I mean, you take the mickey out of both Mrs. Whitehouse and Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, I certainly do.
And there's that wonderful scene where, what was it, Norman Fowler, Secretary of State for Health, was it?
Yes.
Mispronounces the word vagina.
Yes.
How do you do that? Is it vagina?
Vagina.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, I read a book called The End of Innocence, Britain in a Time of AIDS, and it was all sort of documented there that he was trying to push through all this press information about how to stop the spread of HIV and AIDS, I suppose. Mm. And she was trying to not put this information out because it was so rude, she thought. And he thought oral sex was talking dirty, which I make a joke of in the play. Don't think he really knew what cunnilingus was.
Yeah.
And he kept pronouncing vagina wrong in a meeting. So
it's just amazing.
It's sweet, really.
Yeah,
is actually, because you can really take the piss out of that. But actually, what he did was actually quite good.
I mean, read to her. Yes.
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah.
You know, we have a lot to be thankful to him for, I think. Mm.
Yeah, so. And you've got a good joke also, because there's a bit about the sort of miners' strike and gay people coming up and volunteering to help.
That was from my research as well. There was a group called Gays and Lesbians Support the Miners, and they had a disco called Pits and Perverts. So yeah,
you couldn't make it up.
You couldn't, because Mickey in the play is a little political gay man. He in my play, he sets up the group and goes and talks to the miners and helps them and swaps ideas, and there's a bit of a sort of rallying call for them.
At this point, I've just realised that we haven't really explained the title.
Oh yeah, Canary.
Canary. I mean, obviously, when I looked at the poster, I thought, well, that's the brightest dressed bird amongst all the grey crows. But actually, one of your characters has a line: "We're the litmus test of whether a society represents human rights, respects human rights." Sorry, we're the canaries in the mine. Looking at some of the contemporary scenes, wouldn't you say the canaries are still dying in the mine?
Oh, absolutely.
Because,
yeah, absolutely. That's why it's relevant. I mean, it's a quote from Peter Tatchell that he said years ago, and it's always stuck with me. And I, in struggling to find a title for a play that sort of tells the story over such a long time, apart from our gay friends in the north, it's the one that stuck with me, and I sort of used it as a working title to start with, but now I quite like it. It's quite strong, and it helps for a nice image. But it's very much relevant to today, I think.
But in these contemporary scenes, you also suggest that young people partying, feeling great and part of the gay scene, actually don't care anymore in the way that older generations had to.
It's interesting talking to younger gay people who don't see themselves as any different from heterosexuals in the way that I think gay people of my generation did, that we were marginalised and we sort of celebrated that in a way. And I think gay people of my age had something to fight against. We had Thatcher and we had Clause 28 and we had the way society responded to AIDS. And there isn't as much of that now that's particularly aimed at gay people. So what is the gay community these days? I don't know. There's nothing to sort of glue everyone together as much as there was. And I think, you know, I remember people dying of AIDS, but people 10 years younger than me don't. They don't have first-hand visual experience, or they can't touch that, really. So I think there is a sort of complacency and a flippancy about safer sex. Not with everybody at all, but in the play it's represented by
of
a guy who doesn't care and just says, sod it, if you're going to shag me, then don't use a condom, because if I catch anything, I'll just take pills, fuck it. Which hopefully is shocking, and hopefully it's holding a mirror to the audience and going, this is really bad. He's sort of the most loathsome character in the play, really. I don't know who I hate more, him or Mary Whitehouse, but he's very narcissistic and he just doesn't really care. And so in that level, it's a cautionary tale, I think, to just say, just remember what went before and who got you the right to be that complacent and have a think
about because rights that are struggled for can sometimes slip away. It's also very much what I would call a gay issue play. And some might say, Jonathan, it's so very 1980s. I mean, how would you respond to that? I mean,
it is a bit of gay history play, so it's always going to be an element of that. But hopefully, I'm hoping that it's a piece that I hope we sort of contextualises where we are today. Mm. And so it's really important that it is about today as well as the 80s and the 60s. So hopefully there's enough going on in the present day to make it less dated.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think lots of it is set in the 80s and lots of it is set in the 90s and the 60s and the 70s. So it's, you know, if it feels a bit dated, it's probably that. But hopefully the issues are still relevant today, so it shouldn't be too bad.
And the final question, how would you like audiences to respond to it?
I want them to be really challenged by it, really. It's not five people sitting in a room telling jokes. It's, I want them to be shocked and angry and touched and moved, and just to try and make them think, really. Because I think when I did the research for it and I read stuff, I felt all those things. And and I think drama can be brilliant if it does those things. Mm. So if I've caught a tenth of all the feelings that I felt reading these stories, then I'll be pleased. But I hope they're entertained as well. Hopefully it's done in an entertaining way.
Yeah.
Where they can also have a laugh and a good night out. But, you know, I'd feel slightly like I'd done my job wrongly if all people said at the end was, "God, that was bloody hilarious. That was such a funny play."
Yeah.
I'd go, "Ooh, no. Yeah, you're allowed to laugh, but..." Yeah. I want you to be traumatised. Not traumatised. I want you to be shocked and concerned.
Yeah.
And challenged.
And would you like people to go back and find out more about history?
I think so. Mm. Particularly if they're gay people, because I think historically we don't have children to pass stories down to. I know all my family stories. I know everything about my nan, and my nan was the eldest of 12 kids, and I know all their family, the family folklore.
Yep.
And it's like the family silver. And what happens to that when you're gay? And you haven't got kids. And so I did feel a bit like Kim Cattrall on Who Do You Think You Are doing this, but I thought I was learning my family tree. So I did find it exciting, and I didn't want to stop reading those books. And when I realised now I've got to put the books down and start writing, because there's not that many books, it has to be said. That was quite a sad, mournful moment. Yeah. I just was sort of nourished and replenished by it and excited, and all the stuff I just didn't know that people... And I thought, would I have been as brave as these people?
Well, that's a good question, isn't it?
And I just don't
know. Yeah,
yeah. Am I a bit of a coward? I don't know. Mm. Hopefully I'm not.
Yeah.
But it was a really interesting journey to go on.
Mm. And politically, you'd like people now to say, well, look, you know, whatever we've got had to be fought for, and... Yeah. We might have to do that again.
I think it's interesting that while the play is on, there'll be the general election, and you know, the Tories may well get in, and then they'll be saying, "Look, you know, this is what it was like under the last Tory government. You know, this is what Thatcher did. Don't forget."
Mm. And there's, you know, all those indicators. I mean, Cameron and this obsession with the family values, rewarding marriage again. You know, this kind.
Although I think he's claiming civil partnerships is included.
Oh yes, that's right. Yes.
But you know, you've only got to look at that. Is it Andy Grayling who said the stuff about the B&B that hoteliers should have every right to turn away gay people? Yeah. I still think it's the easiest form of abuse. You know, to pick on someone because they're gay, and it's sort of acceptable.
Yeah. In the way that racism almost. Isn't anymore.
Absolutely. You know, if you're going to use racist abuse in the classroom, you'll probably, someone will come down on you as a ton of brick, like a ton of bricks.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had a gay friend of mine saying, using the gay as in, "Oh, that's so gay," as in, "That's so crap."
Yeah, yeah.
I had to pull him up about it. He was mortified. He hangs around with a lot of young people, shall we say. And it just slipped out. And that, things like that I don't like, you know.
Yeah.
The misappropriation of the word.
Yeah. Okay, well, good luck. I know you're still in rehearsals, and good luck with the cutting, if you're cutting.
I think I've done all my cutting now, but yeah.
And thank you for talking to Theatre Voice.
Thank you very much.